From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Mars Artifacts. Sir Charles Schulz III joins us. I'm looking forward to that. Here's what's happening. Still a very tense situation on the eastern part of the United States, as at least 2 million people now remain without power following storms that have been blamed for 22 deaths now since Friday. Amid ongoing heat waves, utilities are warning that it could take several more days to restore electricity to many households. Maryland, West Virginia, Ohio, the District of Columbia declared states of emergency over the weekend. Power outages persisted from North Carolina to New Jersey and as far west as Illinois. Now, Christopher Burt's fascination with extreme weather began at birth. Chris was born during New York's most severe hurricane on record. That was Hurricane Hazel. And Chris studied meteorology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Chris, can you remember a time period where it's been this hot?
Really, actually, not since 1936. So far as June is concerned, there have been more extreme heat records broken, all-time maximum temperatures broken this past June since 1936. So 1936 went on to be one of the most extraordinary summers in U.S. history. Already we have seen 18, I follow 300 cities in the U.S. that have long periods of record going back to the 1890s and that are evenly geographically and climate-wise distributed across the U.S. And 18 of those 300 cities have already, in June, broken their all-time warmest temperature on record.
And at what point, Christopher, do they start saying, you know what, we're going to have to start conserving water here because it's happening?
Quite concerned about, especially in the Midwest, the corn crop, I think it's really starting to suffer. And right now we're looking at another heat dome beginning to build over the Midwest. Yeah. I just was looking, they're forecasting temperatures up to 104 degrees in Madison, Wisconsin by Friday. That's close to 2 degrees short of their all-time record. But all across the plains, this next heat wave is probably going to really hit the north, upper Midwest and the northern plains. And I'm sure the farmers there are sweating bullets about what's coming up, the dry conditions and this extreme heat.
Christopher, do you think something's going on with the sun?
No. You know, I'd always thought it's a cyclical thing. Actually, the sun is in a cool cycle, has been for the last 12 years, what we call a solar minimum. So it has nothing to do with the sun. In fact, it temperatures for the last 12 years globally should be cooler than they have been over the historical average.
Okay, Christopher, thanks for the update on the weather condition. And if you know of an elderly person who is living in a home that doesn't have air conditioning and you're in one of these areas that are getting hit with this extreme high temperatures, bring them home for a little bit. You know, maybe let them even spend the night, especially if you know them. If you don't, well, hopefully there's some kind of shelter that they may be able to get to. You know, of all the threats facing humanity, the one that could really wipe us off the map, a hit by truly massive asteroids, gets relatively little in terms of resources. But the B612 Foundation aims to change that with the launch of a space telescope that would try to track 500,000 asteroids in the inner solar system, believed to be larger than the one that hit Russia's Tunguska in 1908, causing enormous widespread damage there. The Tunguska object size and nature remains a matter of debate, but only 1% of larger asteroids have been mapped so far, according to B612, which was named after the fictional asteroid home of the Little Prince. Here's James McCanny, physicist with us here, who has, of course, been with us for a long time. James, what do you think of the story about a space telescope to look for asteroids?
Well, it's a great idea. It's amazing that a private foundation is taking this on. And NASA has programs I find that the NASA programs are very much lacking. They do look for objects, but you have to understand the government has a two-tiered layer at looking at objects in outer space. You have the military stuff, which we never see or hear about. They're located in Maui, up in the crater on the island of Maui in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And they have some of the biggest supercomputers there in the world, crunching data on these, but that really doesn't filter to the public. NASA's public or visible program is a good program, but it's amazing, as I say, that a private foundation is taking this upon themselves, and I think it's a good idea. I hope they can fulfill this. But then again, we're always left with the quandary of what do we do if we find one that's got a number on it? What, you know, blowing it up isn't a good idea because then you just have a lot of pieces coming at you. If you try and move it, then you have to ask the question, do we have enough good data on the object to move it in the right direction? Because say you knew a year or two in advance, well, it would take a slight nudge to move it. But if your data is wrong, then you might move it into a direct collision course with Earth unwittingly. So it's a tough problem. So first of all, you need the data. Second of all, the solution of what to do is we don't have it here yet because simply the data is not good enough yet. And the understanding of how these orbits might work and how they might be altered within that, say, a 1 or 2 year period, we don't really have a good handle on that either. So, but I applaud the, like you say, the B6 Foundation for taking this program on and moving forward.
It's just a matter of time, isn't it, Jim? Just a matter of time. You know, scientists working at the world's biggest atom smasher plan to announce Wednesday that they have gathered enough evidence to show that the long-sought God particle answering fundamental questions about the universe almost certainly does exist. But after decades of work and billions of dollars spent, the researchers at CERN say they aren't quite ready to say that they've discovered the particle. Instead, the experts familiar with the research there at the Swiss-French border say the massive data that they have obtained will essentially show the footprint of the key particle known as the Higgs boson, all but proving it exists, but doesn't allow them to say that it has actually been glimpsed. For particle physicists, finding the Higgs boson is a key to confirming the standard model of physics that explains what gives mass to matter and, by extension, how the universe was formed. Massachusetts police are hunting for the shooter of a 16-year-old Maine girl who was struck in the arm while riding with her family along a major intersection in what authorities are calling a road rage incident. The girl was traveling with her family in I-495 north on Merrimack, Massachusetts, when she was hit by a gunshot from another car. Witnesses told police that there had been some sort of highway dispute involving the two cars. Road rage. Why do people do it? Why do they lose it? Howard Bloom joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Howard Bloom, founding board member of the Epic of Evolution Society, the Darwin Project. Howard is the member of the International Society for Human Ethology and the Human Behavior and Evolutionary Society. He is a noted author, The Genius of the Beast, The Lucifer Principle, The Global Brain. And whenever we turn to these issues that affect mankind, we turn to Howard Bloom. We're talking about road rage and why people do these weird things. Howard, welcome back.
Thanks, George. And the irony on this road rage thing is that it all comes down to the animals inside of us. There's something we share with lobsters, lizards, puppies, just about every kind of animal you can see, and that is we get angry very easily. But we get angry within a framework, and the framework manages to maintain peace. And the framework that maintains peace is called a dominance hierarchy, and it's nasty. And the person who originally discovered it was a guy named Thorleif Sheldrup Ebb, who was a bit horrified by it. His parents, this is a kid growing up outside of Oslo, Norway. His parents are sculptors. They have money. So they rent a house in the country. Why do you rent a house in the country and take your six-year-old to a house in the country? Because it's nature, and going back to nature brings you peace, right?
That's supposed to.
Yeah, so they have this house in the country, and their little six-year-old is watching chickens out there. And what does he see among the chickens? The chickens are establishing this thing he will eventually call a dominance hierarchy. There's a lead chicken, and she has every privilege you can possibly imagine. She is the first one to go to the trough. She has the best real estate. All the other chickens kowtow to her. And then there's a number two chicken, and the number two chicken goes second, is not quite as privileged as the first, and there's a number three, a number four, a number five. And finally, there's the chicken on the very bottom of the pecking order, who generally is featherless, because all the other chickens feel free to peck her. Now, this is so horrible to this six-year-old that he calls it despotism. But he starts at the age of 10, well, his parents buy him his own flock of chickens because he's so fascinated with these birds. And at the age of 10, he starts taking detailed notes on everything these chickens do. And these chickens are mean and brutal and bullies, and they automatically will attack a chicken below them on the pecking order. Now, here's where road rage comes in. In essence, the dominance hierarchy, as brutal as it is, produces peace. Every chicken knows her order in the pecking order. And as long as they follow the rules and go when they're supposed to the trough, everything is relatively fine, just a little bit of bullying going on. But if you take a new chicken and throw her into the bunch, or worse yet, if you take a bunch of chickens from different packs, different groups, flocks, and you put them all together and there's no dominance hierarchy established yet, you have road rage. Yeah. Those chickens battle each other madly. Why? Because they're trying to establish a new dominance hierarchy, and unfortunately, new dominance hierarchies are brutal. And that's what you see out on the highway when you've got a bunch of people who know how to behave to their neighbors, they know how to behave to their family, they've already got an established position in the family and in the neighborhood, they know even how to behave at the office. But suddenly, they're chickens out of their flocks, and they're up against each other out on a crowded road like I-495 where that shooting incident took place in Massachusetts this weekend, and all hell breaks loose.
What possesses somebody, though, Howard, to reach for their guns? Sure, they're angry, but, you know, move on. Go away. Instead, you reach for the gun, and you actually shoot it into a car, and you could probably kill someone. This little girl's injured.
There's a little difficulty. When you and I are talking to each other on the radio and when people are listening to us, that's our conscious self in charge, and our conscious self knows how to behave itself. The animal self is a kind of non-conscious self living inside of us, and it nudges us around and makes suggestions at various times, but it very seldom gets us out of control. But when you have a battle, all of a sudden, people lose it. One day, once upon a time, a long time ago, I was crossing the Brooklyn Bridge on my bicycle, and there was a guy that I saw every day crossing in the opposite direction, and I finally decided to just nod to him courteously. Uh-huh. I nodded to him. He punched me in the side of the head very fiercely. My bicycle hit a lamppost and was dysfunctional. The front tire was really collapsed, and I had to carry it home. So we went to the police, my wife and I, and asked if they would help us get this guy because he crossed the bridge at the same time every day, and they refused because they were busy watching soap operas. I'm not kidding, George. They did not want to interrupt their soap operas.
Unbelievable.
But one little guy waited until he came outside with us. He didn't want his friends to see what he was going to do, and he said, look, my father has been attacked 4 times, and I'm afraid the next time they're going to kill him, and I'm as concerned about this kind of violence as you are. So call me tomorrow morning when you're about to cross the bridge. I'll cross the bridge with you. Now, as I'm crossing the bridge with this wonderful little guy who is really concerned about civic order and stuff like that, as we get closer to the spot where he anticipates running into my attacker, he changes dramatically. He is not the same person anymore. And he says, look, you know, when there's violence around, you're not in your normal state. So if I say things that you think are violent, if I say things that you find totally out of taste, remember, I'm not in control of myself anymore. And that's what happens to you when you're about to confront violence. Well, he's right, because as you get closer to the spot, he changes dramatically.
So he was going to go. He was going to go ballistic on this guy, wasn't he?
Yes, he was going to go ballistic, but he knew himself well enough to know that you go ballistic in certain situations. Now, if you're a policeman, you are trained to control yourself even in a ballistic situation. If you are in the military, presumably you are trained to use that ballistic nature inside of you, but to control it. However, you haven't been trained that way. I haven't been trained that way. The people on I-495 haven't been trained that way. The people in the road rage incident in New Jersey haven't been trained that way. The guys in Augusta, Georgia with a road rage incident in the last 24 hours haven't been trained that way. And the people out in Utah who ran into a road rage incident are the ones in Joliet, because all of these are major road rage incidents. There were 3,270 road rage incidents reported on, or at least there were 3,200 stories that show up on Google News in the last 24 hours.
It's crazy.
Road rage.
Well, Howard, and most of the road rage, most of it occurs when the road rager gets cut off or he thinks the person's a bad driver, and then he goes nuts, and then he chases them for that. I had an example today. Let me tell you about my story. In St. Louis, you're allowed in many places to make a right-hand turn on a red light, unless it's posted that you can't. At this particular intersection I was at, there were two lanes that you could turn right from, the inside lane and the one on the outside, and then there was a third lane, but you could only go left. So two can go to the right. I'm in the one on the middle, and I was going to make my right when the traffic cleared, and there's another person on the inside of me, and they could also make their right. Well, we both leave at the same time to make our respective rights, but that person on the far right-hand lane, instead of just making a right onto their lane, they cut across into my lane as I'm going. I almost hit them. I did not. The old me might have chased them a long, long time ago. I don't do that anymore. And off they went, and I just kind of shook my head like, what a lousy driver. It's caused a lot by that. People who get offended or cut off, they're the ones that go nuts. How come?
Well, let me tell you a little story. There is a phenomenon that was researched in the 1940s called the frustration-aggression hypothesis. And they tested it in a lot of different ways, but they take a rat, and they train a rat in going down the equivalent of a little bowling alley. And when it got to the end of the bowling alley, it got cheese. Fantastic. Life is superb. Every time you go down the bowling alley, you get cheese. Then they erected a barrier to frustrate the poor rat. The rat by now knew there was cheese at the end of the runway. And they put up a little electrical grid. So the rat came running down the runway to get its cheese, and whammo, all of a sudden, its feet fried. And now the question is, how does the rat deal with this? Well, when there's nobody else around, they have no idea. The rat just looks perplexed and goes into a tizzy. But if they provide it with what looks like another rat, for example, if they took a bottle brush and they put it next to the cheese, guess what the rat, who was suddenly frustrated by the equivalent of being cut off at the intersection, does? He beats the bejesus out of that bottle brush.
Yeah.
If you give him a smaller rat, he will also beat the bejesus out of the smaller rat. Or you put seven rats on a hot plate and you turn the heat up, the six rats will immediately feel out who's the weakest rat in the bunch, and they will beat the whatever it's called. Out of the rat that they determine is on the bottom. And the guys who came up with this hypothesis were interested in far more than just lab tests on rats. They were interested in the lynchings that were going on down in the South at the time. So they gathered a whole bunch of cotton price statistics, because the so-called rednecks of the South were very dependent on cotton as their major way of making a living in those days. And they discovered that if you tracked cotton prices, when cotton prices went down and all of a sudden farmers were in danger of losing their shirts and losing their farms, guess what happened to lynchings? The lynchings went up.
They went up, way up.
Yeah, right. And that's the frustration aggression hypothesis. There you are in the inner lane, another guy tries to cut you off. You are the rat with the hot plate. You are the rat with the electrified grid. You can't get to what you expect to get to. And there's another factor, and this has to do with dominance cues and submission cues. because there are dominance hierarchies, we give off dominance cues. Oh, I'm important. You're less important than I am. Or, oh, no, I'm not threatening your position, officer, not at all. And we do that in part with the clothing we wear, and we do it in part with the automobiles that we buy. In almost every incident that made the headlines over the weekend, there was at least one SUV. In the fatal incident in New Jersey, where you had two SUVs crashing into each other and a grandmother sitting in a seat without her seatbelt being ejected and dying on the spot.
That's a good one. Howard, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break and come back, talk more with you, and also take questions and also road rage stories next on Coast to Coast AM. Alrighty, welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie, Howard Bloom, our guest this hour as we talk about road rage. We'll take your calls in just a moment. Howard, are you saying then that the people who drive maybe the bigger vehicles are a little more aggressive on the road?
Well, there's this thing we call attitude, and you can show it with your car by buying an SUV, and yes, I'm bigger than all the rest. I mean, dominance gestures and submission gestures come into this all over the place. Attitude is about dominance and submission gestures. If you're the lead chicken in the group, if you're the number one chicken, you stand up tall. You look magnificent. If you're a human and you're showing dominance gestures, you speak with a deep voice. You stand up tall, too. You make yourself look as big as possible. And if you don't want to get into trouble with somebody and he happens to be your boss or even your boss's boss, you are a little bit slumped over when you're walking or talking. Your voice is not as aggressive by any stretch of the imagination. You want to make yourself look small. So you've got in the Massachusetts incident that took place in the last 24 to 48 hours, you had two cars on I-495. The drivers got into an altercation, and both drivers were showing attitude. One was showing attitude by owning a Nissan Xterra, which is a big SUV. The other probably couldn't afford the money for an Xterra and was showing attitude by having a white Honda Accord with smoked windows. The people in the little Honda Accord, much smaller than Xterra, were wearing sunglasses. Another sign of attitude, another way of showing dominance gestures. So when these people got out of their cars and started fighting each other, you got two groups trying to assert their dominance over each other. And finally, one person in the smaller car, the car that feels really threatened and squashed.
Like a little smart car.
Pulls out a gun. Right. He shoots one of the girls in the big Xterra in the arm. So that was the big incident. Two people trying to show attitude, trying to show dominance gestures. Now out on a highway, outside their own flocks, and suddenly trying to assert dominance over each other.
Okay, to the calls we go. We'll go to Kevin, who's driving in Green Bay, Wisconsin right now. Hey, Kevin, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, George, how's it going?
Good.
I had a quick question for your guest tonight.
Sure thing.
I'm sorry, I missed his name. I deliver pizza for a living, and obviously road rage and pizza delivery probably goes hand in hand. So... my question is if there's any exact correlation between, like, drivers that are on a very tight time schedule and higher instances of road rage.
Howard Bloom, what do you think?
Well, that's a good question, and I haven't seen any statistics on it. The one thing we know is that there are 1,500 road rage incidents that lead to serious injury or death a year. And if you follow the frustration-aggression hypothesis and you've got people like you, I mean, you're in a perfect position. Not just to observe this, but to have to control it. If you're on a deadline of some sort, then presumably your level of frustration would be higher, and presumably your level of aggression would be higher, except there's a problem. You, like a guy in the military or like that policeman that I was crossing a bridge with, do this for a living. And because you do this for a living, you have to endure this kind of frustration all the time. Now, if every time you run into a frustrating situation, you jump out of your car and threaten somebody with a BB gun, which is what happened in Augusta, Georgia in the last 24 hours, you would never get your pizza delivered. So there is a good chance that you learn to control yourself in ways that people who don't spend their entire day in a car don't learn.
Are cab drivers aggressive in terms of road raging? I've been in a lot of cabs in my life. They're tough, aggressive drivers. But I've never seen them chase somebody or anything like that.
No, they don't get out of the car. I mean, look, New York is the capital of this kind of thing, and I really admire drivers who are able to see a little opening that seems to be of a 16th of an inch in size and squeeze their entire cab into it while going 35 miles an hour. It's a skill. It's an art. It's like driving with somebody at the Indy 500. But no, I have never, in all the years I've lived in New York City, which is about 40, I have never seen a driver get out of his car, because that's when the money stops.
Next up, David's in Reno, Nevada, and you're on Coast to Coast with Howard Bloom. David, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Howard. How are you guys tonight?
Good.
Hi, David.
Good. I got a little story for you. I live in a quiet little neighborhood, and my wife's a nurse, and she called me about 11:30, a couple weeks ago, and told me she forgot her lunch. Sometimes she makes a lunch, brings it with her, save a few bucks, So she says, can you bring me my lunch? I left it in the fridge. I'm like, sure. When do you need it? She says, about a half hour. So I take my time. I get in my car, going through my quiet little neighborhood. No, two lanes going each way. No cars anywhere. And I see this kid pull up behind me kind of fast. I didn't know it was a kid at the time. He's probably about 20, 22-ish. And he pulls up to me, right up to my rear end. I'm like, go around, man. I'm in no hurry. I'm going down the road to the hospital to drop off my wife's lunch. I don't, go around. And he's like honking his horn and flashing his brights. So I'm just like minding my business with my seatbelt on, driving the speed limit. And he's just weaving around, trying to run me off the road. He pulls up next to me. He's like, get out of the car. Pull over. I'm going to kill you. I'll kick your, whatever. And he's not going to get you. And I'm like, just go on, go around. And so I'd slow down and he'd slow down. It was like he was looking for a conflict. And I was like, what do I do here? So I just took a quick turn and turned off and got away from him. But, I mean, there was no reason at all for any kind of conflict. He could have went around me with the greatest of ease. And it was just ridiculous. It terrified me. So, I mean, there's people out there, I don't know why, I don't know if it's drugs or whatever, or they're just angry or just, a lot of crazy behavior going on. And if I could, George, could I send out, I just found out my dear friend, I just got a phone call, he got a brain tumor. Now, he's a drummer in a band with me, and he was acting kind of strange the last week or two, and we just found out that he got a brain tumor, and he has to have emergency surgery tonight or tomorrow.
Well, let's pray everything works out.
Just a wonderful drummer's name's Lee, and if everybody could just say a prayer for him, I'd really appreciate that. I'll hang up and listen to my response.
Okay, David. Go ahead, Howard. You want to react to that?
Well, first of all, I will pray, despite the fact that I'm an atheist, I will pray for your drummer. That's a horrible thing to happen. But the second thing is that you've been victimized, David, by a human condition, a very abnormal human condition called adolescence. It's something that happens to people not just at the age of 13, but continues happening into their early 20s. And it continues happening. Remember, we've talked about how a chicken within its flock, which knows its place, manages to maintain peace. Yes, there's bullying. Yes, there's a little bit of nastiness, but basically there's peace. Take a chicken out of its flock, and it has to establish a whole new hierarchy, and there's all kinds of trouble. There's all kinds of mayhem and violence. Well, kids from the age of 13 to approximately 30 have ejected themselves from their familiar environment, from their familiar pecking order. They've ejected themselves from their family, and they are entering a society that is relatively hostile to them. In fact, in some societies, the society handles the problem by turning all of them into warriors and sending them off to make war and be violent against somebody else, not us. They organize this kind of violence. Nonetheless, until you've basically established a wife, until you've established a place to live, until you've established yourself in a field that you're going to make a living in, you are on the loose. You are continually a chicken in between its flocks. And as a consequence, adolescents tend to be more violent. Adolescents tend to have more highway accidents. Adolescents do everything in their power, in some cases, to show off their dominance cues. The entire business of playing a game of chicken is all about taking a chance with death. And
that's
it's all about dominance cues. Who can come out on top of whom? And not all adolescents become violent. In fact, very few become violent. But it's a time in which the violence among us increases, the amount of frustration and aggression increases, and especially this attempt to establish a place in a pecking order is just showing itself all over the place, and that's what you ran into on the highway.
Howard, do tougher times, like rougher economic times, show more road rage episodes?
Well, if we go back to the frustration aggression research of the 1940s and 1950s, where they correlated, times are hard, cotton prices go down, people are in danger of losing their farms, they're in danger of losing the living they need to keep their family alive, then the violence goes up. But there's another tendency, life is paradoxical, nature is paradoxical, and there's another tendency as well. When times are good, this is going to sound really ironic, it's in my book, The Lucifer Principle. When times are good, murder rates go up. When times are hard, murder rates go down. That's because, nature is extremely paradoxical, and that includes our nature. And when we sense that times are good, we sometimes get antsy and anxious and ambitious. And we begin to think that we can accomplish things we didn't think that we could accomplish before. And one of those things we try to accomplish sometimes takes place at the price of another human being's comfort or another human being's life. When times are bad, we go into something called learned helplessness, and our system floods us with something called substance P. And substance P makes us drag around, makes us feel as if we can't accomplish a thing. In dogs and rats, where this has been studied, you take a dog or rat, you put it in a cage, you electrify the floor, the rat gets sizzled all the time. The rat at first jumps all around in the cage, tries to find every conceivable way to exit, and then if it just can't find a way to stop the shocks, if it can't find a way to stop the pain, eventually it lays down right on the floor that's giving it shocks, and it doesn't move. Now, in about 75% of the cases, a rat will still, if you open the door, or a dog, will see the opening and will walk out. But with 25% of the cases where these systems are flooded with substance P, the rat sees the open door and doesn't move. It continues to lay there on the floor and take the shocks. That's called learned helplessness. So when times are bad, a small proportion of us go into learned helplessness and don't think we can accomplish anything. Do we try to beat up on our neighbors? Not by a long shot. If other people beat up on us, we will lay there as if we've been anesthetized. So these things, again, the tendencies whipsaw back and forth in both directions.
Good point. Let's go next to Lorenzo, driving in El Paso, Texas. Hey, good morning, Lorenzo.
Good morning. How are you both?
Good, sir. Good.
My question was, you were talking about the bigger vehicles being the dominant vehicles on the road and things like that. My question with you is, I had an incident up there in Chicago. I've been driving for about 15 years, and I have noticed that throughout the years, people are getting worse and worse, angrier and angrier. We used to get a lot of respect from people out here on the road. I mean, trucks are big, they're loaded heavy, and it'll take a whole football field for it to come to a complete stop.
But that's right.
You can imagine the destruction while you're trying to stop within that football field. And I mean, My incident was I was running out of lane, and I had my signal to move over, and the vehicle next to me just wouldn't slow down or speed up to let me over. So it came to a decision where I had to push that vehicle out of the way, and I just eased her on into the lane as slow as I could. She knew what I was doing. After she got angry, passed me, got it right in front of me, and I couldn't believe what she did. She slammed her brakes.
Oh,
and my partner at the time, driving team, said, "Larry, look out!" And I hit my J brake. It's an engine retarder. The truck slows down dramatically, and she did this like three or four times. But I kept my distance away from him. This was early in the middle of rush hour, early in the morning. Now, what would cause a person something that idiotic?
I mean, and she could have been killed had you smashed her. Howard, why would they do that? Take their own life
into
their
hands. I was about to say that we humans are highly competitive beasts, but given the fact that rats compete, given the fact that lobsters compete, given the fact that lizards compete, all of us with four legs or two legs, we have hands, but they're still legs, but all of us animals are extremely competitive beasts. And again, you take us out of our established milieu where we've been beaten into position, and we test each other against each other. We can't help it. We play games for sports. We play tiddlywinks and chess and Parcheesi. We play video games. We do all kinds of things to test ourselves against each other. It's so deeply built into our nature that it forms the basis for some of our pleasures. Again, things like sport. The only reason we don't regard it as normal is because normally we are living within an established pecking order.
But for somebody to, you know, road rage where they could get killed, they're not thinking outward, are they?
No, they're not thinking. Again, we have two different selves, and one is the animal non-conscious self, and it's very, very powerful. I mean, it takes care of things like breathing and walking, which are highly complex, especially walking, a highly complex thing. But we walk around objects without even noticing that we've walked around the object, without even noticing that we've seen it, because the non-conscious brain is taking care of that. But the non-conscious brain is also highly emotional and highly competitive. In the actual structure of the brain, it's called the lizard brain, because that's how primitive it is. It goes back to the time when our ancestors were the ancestors of lizards. In fact, it goes back so far in time, this is 500 million years, it goes back in time, half a billion years, when we shared a common ancestor with lobsters, with insects, with lizards, and of course with all the rest of us mammals. So this competitive stuff is way, way deep in our brain. And sometimes when it takes over everything else, watch out, because
that's a good
point. It
can
make us blind to our normal conscious selves.
Brian, first time caller in Toledo. Hey, Brian, go ahead.
Oh, hi, George.
Hi.
Howard. I'm a former truck driver. I have about 5.5 years and about just a tick under 1 million miles of driving experience.
Wow.
And my challenge to you is what I've been hearing over the phone while I've been on hold and what I've heard earlier is you're comparing humans to rats. And
yes.
What is a great scientific maybe discovery or behavior with humans, my challenge to you is to find a company and a driver and get in a big truck and ride with him or her and really see what road rage is about. That is why I dropped out of trucking.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I used to drive with
like
a driver
with
a great big truck.
Just a tick under 1 million miles, accident-free, and I've seen people prone and died. I've been cut off, everything by a motorcycle to the military for all things. And
what was the worst incident?
What drove me out of it?
You ever had?
What's the worst time you ever had, Brian, incident that you saw?
New York City, George Washington Bridge. Number one, it cost me $35 to get over it out of my own money. And I got cut off by a taxi cab. And I went to right like we were trained to do. And this was in 06. And brushed up against the guardrail, ground everything to halt. And I had all kinds of everybody, highway patrol, New York police, they want to find me, but they don't want to go after the person that cut me off. And what, you know, I gave my statement and it's all public information and everything. And, you know, I'm the one at fault, yet the person that cut me off gets away with it.
Well, let me ask you though, Brian, did he cut you off because he was raging or was he just a poor driver?
Because I was raging?
No. Was he chasing you? Was he road raging you? Or was he just a poor driver? I mean, accidents do happen.
He was a poor driver. And
yeah.
He just blatantly, you know, in New York City, I know this before I even drove a truck. If you don't drive like New Yorkers, you're going to crash. I know that.
Well, you know, there's look, in when you're driving somewhere, if you rear end someone, even if that person stops in front of you, on the freeway, it's your fault. It's the guy in the back gets blamed all the time. Howard, thanks again. You're always an expert when it comes to humankind. Howard Bloom, Howard's website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'll be back in a moment with Sir Charles Schulz III. Going to talk a little bit about Mars on Coast to Coast AM.